Let's just talk a little bit about Revelation here. Remember, Revelation is kind of a vision given by Jesus to John to the seven churches. And we see Jesus in a position where we see some of the glory that he has in heaven, obviously not the full glory, because that would be beyond us. And we see lots of imagery used because what he's talking about is something that's greater than we can really understand. So we use kind of earthly imagery, which is lesser but more familiar, to think about something that's greater. For example, as he talks to seven churches, he is warning them and us about dangers which can cost us our eternal life, our salvation. And one of the images that's used is Jesus has a sword in his mouth. And the whole point is, if you don't listen to his words, you're running the risk of being killed eternally. And that gives us kind of a graphic feel for the significance of what's being said. We see then Jesus being honored in heaven's glorious context as he's dealing with these, talking to these seven churches. And we see him being praised through the fact that by the cross he has saved many who would have been lost if the cross had not occurred. And since the book is about saving, about not doing that which would risk your salvation, a lot of what he says to the seven churches is warnings. And they're warnings about three general categories of mistake or error. One is not enduring worldly hostility, which is a major theme of the book. God and the followers of Jesus have a natural difference between those who follow the world, and that difference can lead to a great deal of conflict, and at times the world can be very hostile. And some churches need to be reminded to endure those who are being oppressed, particularly. A second type of sin is that they're false teachers that have been tolerated in some churches. So he wants the readers to be aware of the danger of the false teachers, to not listen to them, to not follow them. And in some cases, they want the leaders of the church to not tolerate them. I think that's ambiguously written because a considerable number of the people in the church in those days were slaves, and they didn't have the ability to say who was going to be tolerated and who was not going to be tolerated. So for them, it's just don't follow them, don't listen to them. The third was there are certain sins which become prevalent in a church, and that is perhaps one of the most difficult things to face. If you're in a church where sin is prevalent, there's an inclination to think, well, this isn't a big deal. So I always like the Laodicean example. The people in Laodicea all sat there and thought, oh, everything's wonderful. Everything's great. We're rich. We're successful. And in fact, they were in spiritual poverty because they were focusing on human, earthly riches, not upon riches in the sense of being rich in God's blessing. and human riches are not an evidence of God's favor. There are lots of people who have human riches that are not doing what God wants at all. And then we see in the book a discussion of the kind of conflict that is occurring, or the kind of stresses that are occurring as Jesus is unsealing the book of life, which is showing who is going to be saved. And that conflict is considerable. Now, it's interesting. The context of that conflict is God is in control. He's saving those whom he plans to save, and he's judging those who reject him. So, in a theological sense, everything's under control, But when you look out the window and you're on earth, it doesn't look that way. It may not look that way at all. And so people need to keep that perspective. And we're going to see in the book, and have seen, considerable amounts of things that might not look like God's in control and everything's being run properly, but it is. So that as, for example, believers are oppressed, they can be confident that that is part of God's plan for them and it is for their eternal good. So what you see isn't what you see, in a certain sense. Now, most recently, we've been on the fifth and sixth trumpet in chapter 9. And we saw the fifth trumpet leading to suffering for unbelievers only. And that reflected the fact that unbelievers were hearing worldly lies. And those worldly lies have a sting in the tail. So if you believe them, they make your life miserable even now on earth for a time. And believers who know they are worldly lies are therefore protected by that. And we saw, this is kind of the mirror of the ceiling, which we saw back in chapter 7, where God protects his people, both on earth and then later eternally. The sixth trumpet, which we started last time, has to do with the fact that those worldly lies, these ideas that are inappropriate, if you believe them and you never change in that belief, lead to eternal death. So they're very dangerous sorts of things. It kind of fits the sword in the mouth of Jesus. And we see in the sixth trumpet that humans are steadily dying all the time. And at the time the readers were reading this originally or hearing it originally, there were lots of humans who were younger dying all the time. In America, we tend to think you don't die until you're old, but that's not always true. But it's certainly less common that young people die quickly as they did in the past. So you've got people dying all the time and other ones going on in their sin, acting like there's no risk, there's no problem. Again, a situation where you can see these lies are very dangerous because you're dying eternally because you believe a lie and you're not being saved in a way that you could. And this, of course, is partly because the world speaks with a very loud voice. And that's one of the things that we sort of saw in the fifth and sixth trumpet. The imagery that's used reflects the fact that, like, that they seem to have crowns on their head and they seem fierce and they seem strong. These are lies that claim to have authority. And the world speaks them. And it spoke them to them and it speaks them to us. Actually, in that particular case, it seems like it's even more obvious to us because we've got computers right in our face with constant lies being put on the computers and constant worldly attitudes being expressed. And from time to time, I sometimes think Americans are the dumbest people in the history of the world because the internet has given us people who are totally ignorant telling us what truth is, and we don't know who necessarily wrote the article that we're reading. And it's hard for humans to wait that. I mean, for all you know, you're reading an article by a North Korean agent who wants you to do something stupid. Or it's written by an 11-year-old person who's having fun. Anyhow. Now, so in the sixth trumpet, I've been talking about the fact that these worldly lies are really, in one sense, following Satan's lies. And we see that in the picture of the image sort of coming up from the abyss. And it's kind of a fog of misinformation and lies coming continuously. And that's been going on throughout the history of the world. And I just want us to look quickly at a couple of passages, which I was going to do last time, and then Karen picked up her hand and said, "Oh, time." So I had to stop, as she's wont to do. And I want us to look at a couple here. And I picked two that come from John, the same person who received the revelation, one from the gospel and one from his first letter, which point out the fact that kind of this worldly system is all part of Satan's system. And I think that's one of the perspectives here that the revelation wants us to have, is that these lies look like they're just what the world is saying. So, the world is saying, for example, it's very, very important to be successful in a human sense. Well, actually, it's not very important. You might get some more toys, as one of my friends says. Well, you might have more security, and you might have a more pleasant existence. I mean, if your roof leaks, it's more pleasant to have a pile of money sitting around to pay for it than none. But at the same time, it's not what life is really about. Remember, history is about, and life is about, God saving some out of a fallen world. That's all of history. That's the only real theme in history. And that's kind of what Revelation has been teaching us. So, having given you kind of a long summary, which I feel like we need to do for a while, let's take a look at a couple of these passages. So I'll take a look first at the John passage. Now, Jesus is having a conflict with the Jews, and he's basically saying they are not really the legitimate children of Abraham. And this is chapter 8, and I'm going to start with verse 42. Jesus said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God, and now I'm here. I have not come on my own, but he sent me. Why is my language not clear to you? Because you are unable to hear what I say. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Yet because I tell the truth, you do not believe me." You get this sense of how the worldly hostility comes from a satanic source. And 1 John, also talks about this kind of issue. I'm going to read 1 John 2:15 through 17 and then 3:8 through 12. "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boastings of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever." And then 3:8 through 12. "He who does what is sinful is of the devil, because the devil has been sinning from the beginning. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. No one who is born of God will continue to sin, because God's seed remains in him. He cannot go on sinning because he has been born of God. This is how we know who the children of God are and who the children of the devil are. Anyone who does not do right is not a child of God, nor is anyone who does not love his brother. This is the message you've heard from the beginning. We should love one another. Do not be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own actions were evil and his brother's were righteous." So this is not, this particular idea is one that John's already articulated, that had been revealed to him by the Spirit before that, or maybe, I'm not sure whether Revelation's before John or 1 John, but they're all similar times, it seems. Now, so I see the plagues being basically lies that Satan gives to the world, and the world gives, and it comes from their mouths. And if you believe, in the case of the sixth trumpet, you die eternally. And in the meantime, your life is fundamentally messed up. Believing those lies leads to a great deal of insecurity and stress and unhappiness here. So you'll be unhappy here and punished for all eternity. It's a fairly harsh judgment. Now, all this tells us, I think, that often the attacks of the world can come from the mouth. One of the things that I worry a little bit about with the modern interpretations of Revelation is it makes it kind of exotic, kind of monster-like things attacking. It feels more like a horror movie. Whereas, in fact, what you just hear on the street or hear on the internet or whatever, or read on the internet, can itself be the source of the attack. And it's right there. And it was there for the seven churches, because if you think about it, they were facing things like false teachers who were telling lies. They were facing a hostile world, and a hostile world normally starts with verbal. Only later does it go to force. And in the United States context, most of the hostility probably is verbal at this point. And in much of history, I think that's been true. The verbal is always a big part of it. And then you have the sin. But if you think of people like in Laodicea, they're sitting there saying, we are rich and prosperous. It's things they're saying, it's kind of spreading sinful attitudes in the church itself. So these verbal things matter. And we see this in Scripture as a whole. There's a lot of warnings about not taking the words of people less than you need to. Being careful what you hear and what you listen to. That's a big part of the battle in the world, bigger than we necessarily think of in some contexts. And we see that some in Revelation. We're going to see later in Revelation 11 a discussion about the two witnesses, and their fire from the mouth of the witnesses will destroy the people of the world. I'm going to try to persuade you that those are the true prophecies, the truth from God, telling them of their eternal judgment, and if they don't listen, they'll be destroyed by their rejection of those thoughts. And in Revelation 19:15, it talks about Jesus striking down his enemies with fire from his mouth. And I think, again, that's going to be his truth, which they reject, which leads to their eternal destruction. So I'm going to argue that from passages in Revelation. But let me go on. Here we come. To look at a few other passages. Oh, good, we have question or comment here, Ken.
So there's 200 million mounted troops, and we've got breastplates and sulfur coming out their mouth and everything else.
This is a very
physical description, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
An overwhelmingly physical description. And you would suggest that it is in a physical way describing the world we live in. It seems to also be more than that, but it...
Yeah, it's kind of imagery. It's an imagery, but remember how we kind of went through the various aspects and how, so you had things coming out of their mouth, which I think are the words, but they had the things that look like crowns on their head, which means they're speaking with what they claim is authority. They're the ones that are right. And then you've got breastplates, which make it sound like they're strong. They're the ones that are being realistic, for example. And so as you kind of look at them, I think it fits the way the world speaks. The world tells us, this is the way life is. We're accurate. We're in an authoritative position. We're the ones that know what we're doing. And, you know, there's a tendency to believe that. When people come along and they say, I'm an expert. In fact, our whole educational system trains us to do that. We all go to school for years and we learn tons of what we believe from people who are our teachers, who claim to be experts. And then it turns out things get a little shakier the more you look. I mean, I don't know if those, if anybody here is a psychologist, they probably are well aware of the current crisis in psychology where somebody utilized the gold standard research techniques of psychology to prove that there's precognition. Now the guy did it tongue in cheek. I don't think he believes there's precognition, but I think he did it to show that the so-called gold standard of research techniques in psychology can give you nonsense. So you can't be quite so sure you can trust it. Or another example of that is like in evolution. We're taught evolution is for sure in our schools. But remember, this is all based on journals where some editor was gatekeeper. And if somebody doesn't agree, he doesn't get published. That means you've got biases. And I was reading an article a while back where one of the guys who is an evolutionist said it wasn't about evolution on Earth. It was about the fact that there's no other life in the universe. I think, well, this is interesting. He said, well, there's no other. And his argument was the odds of evolution actually occurring on Earth were 1,000,000,000,000,000. If you think about all the things that have to work together to make it happen. And since evolution clearly is true, he just assumed it's true, it's got to be true, even though the odds are 1,000,000,000,000 against it. This means that there's no other, probably no other life ever evolved in the galaxy. That's pretty impressive. Now, I have to admit, I'd be a little reluctant to believe something where the odds are 1,000,000,000,000 against it. In fact, I don't think I've ever... I don't think it would occur to me to believe it. I had a friend whose father was a famous physicist, and he did some mathematical statistical work for biologists on evolution, and he came back and said it's impossible. And the biologist said, you don't understand, it's truth. Now... You know, I don't know if the father was perfectly accurate in his calculations, but 1,000,000,000,000 is good enough for me. Generally speaking, I don't like to bet on 1,000,000,000,000 odds. But if you like 1,000,000,000,000 odds, you can play the lotto and get much better odds. Anyhow, so I think the world claims a great deal of authority that it doesn't have. And I think what those imagers are trying to do is to give us a feel for how the world doesn't even want to let you argue. It just wants to overwhelm you. And because eternal life's at stake, that's a big deal. It's like a great army coming to destroy you with lies. And I think the 200 million reflects the fact that the world has a lot of people in it. And most people in the world are not believers. So in fact, there are tons of people saying these ideas all the time. Let's think a little bit about the tongue and what people say in some other passages. This time I'm going to let you interpret the passage for me. That way you can see for yourself better what some of these passages might be saying, let's take a look at James. We're going to go to chapter 3, verses 3 through 12. I'll read the passage. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man. But no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With the tongue we praise our Lord and our Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth comes praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. So what does he tell us about the tongue there? James also says tongue's very important, but he's got a little different take. What's the difference?
It's certainly disproportionately powerful.
It is disproportionately powerful.
Well, I was told a long time ago, and I don't know whether or not it's true, because I don't read Greek, but it says in the Bible that women should not speak in church. And I was told that meant they should not gossip. The word is closer to gossip. So that would involve the tongue.
Okay, they're sins which involve the tongue, like gossip. So you can sin with your tongue directly. Okay? Any other perspectives on what this is kind of telling us that might be a little...
Yeah, it really shows that we have to watch what we think and how we speak. Because
okay.
What comes out of the man is what shows what's in his heart.
Okay. And as a matter of fact, there are other passages that say that, like Luke 6:45 says that. Good. So you've kind of got to... The tongue is not only dangerous in the sense that you got to worry about what the world says, you got to worry about what you say. And... You also have to be careful about the fact that sometimes careless words reflect careless thought as well as just careless words. So what we say can matter. And of course, we know that intuitively. And especially if you're talking about lies where the speaker has an agenda, he can be saying things that are very misleading. The false teachers in the churches were saying things that were very misleading. Oh, you can be a Christian and go ahead and have your sin too. Very designed to appeal to carnal man. John.
Isn't one of the other problems that we face is we're easily manipulated, so we actually become a vehicle for somebody else because we don't engage our minds.
Yeah, we're manipulated, and if you think about that, that's one of the reasons people who are of the world are speaking Satan's words often, even though they don't think they are. They don't intend to. And of course, we've got a whole industry that's in the business of manipulating us by the tongues. I remember when some drug company got an award because they came up with a drug where they had an advertisement for a drug where when they go through all the side effects, you know how if you're watching television and they're telling you about the drug and then they have to tell you about the side effects. Well, half the time after you're done hearing the side effects, I don't care what the drug is. I'm not interested unless I'm dying of cancer or something. And this one got an award because the people who watched the advertisement in control groups didn't notice the side effects part. They had done it so cleverly that even though they fulfilled the law, they figured out a way to evade the law. So they didn't know the side effects or didn't remember them. Dan.
A couple of things here. One, this text tells us that the tongue is independent. And I'm sure that we've all had experiences where we've said something. I didn't mean to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And it catches us.
Yep.
So that's scary.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of it is, in our day, somebody should write the book of James and talk about ears. Because we live in a world in which no matter what words you use, people will interpret the words you say the way they understand the words. And they twist your meaning all out of shape. And once it's left your mouth, you have no control over what people do with what you say. So that in that case, it is the echo effect that is so lethal. It's not what you're saying, but it's what the echoing backdrop sends back, that becomes the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot argue against that. You've lost control because people's ears determine meaning.
Yeah, kind of like the Pharisees and Jesus, where they often misinterpret him seemingly deliberately. John 80's got her.
Over and over again, I've listened to news reports where actually not using the tongue has made a difference because they have said half of the truth or half of the quote and left it at that, like a half a brick.
Yes. Yes, it's very easy to be misleading and be misled. And you don't even have to lie in the sense of saying an untruth if you're clever about it. But you're still deceiving people. And if you think about it, you can see how false ideas can be disseminated so completely. And of course, we see that in the internet in our age. But even in ancient times, the seven churches, you would have had informal kinds of this talking and hearing. And the Pharisees, of course, lived back in that era, and they managed to twist what Jesus said all the time. So it's nothing new that people twist the words. But Dan's right on this ear thing. We all hear everything through our own lens. Sometimes I'll be reading an article or hearing somebody talk. Actually, I tend to read a lot, so I get all my news and stuff from reading. So I tend to think of it as reading, not hearing. But I'll be reading an article, and I'll stop and about two sentences into it and say, oh, I know what you're going to say. Forget it. And most of the time, I'm happier that I did it. But it does mean there's certain kinds of ideas that are never going to get through if I think they're going a certain way. So there's a lot here that can cause us to be completely twisted and distorted. And we don't even know it. Or we don't even see it, how forceful it is, or how clever it is, You know, all you got to go do is go back to Genesis chapter 3. The Satan lied to Eve, deceived her, and she believed him. And a disaster accrued of the first magnitude. That's probably why they have snakes on the back of some of these images of the lies, to remind us of what happened in Genesis 3. And it also helps you get a better feel for certain passages. Remember when Peter and Jesus were talking, and Jesus talks about his need to be crucified, and Peter said, no. And then Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." Now that sounds incredibly harsh. But if you think about the fact that kind of this worldly perspective ultimately comes from Satan and his ideas, it's actually a very accurate portrayal. So you don't want to be speaking the words of Satan if you repeat what you think are just natural worldly human ideas. You can do that without thinking about it. It's always been an interesting passage, because my original response to that was, gee, he seems kind of harsh there towards Peter. But I think he's making a point that Peter needed to get. If you think in human terms only, then you're in a mode that's not thinking in faith. You're thinking in the world's view, which is driven by a satanic world view. This also helps explain this whole idea that you've got something where the believers are sealed against it, and the world, but the world is not, and people of the world are being crushed by something, and the believers aren't being. Because remember, that's one of the themes in Revelation. That's one of the themes in earlier prophets, too. I remember once I was reading a passage in Isaiah, and it says, now you're talking about Judah and its problems, and there's lots of prophecies about judgment coming mixed in here. And then all of a sudden it says, "The path of the righteous is level. O upright one, you make the way of the path righteous smooth. Yes, Lord, walking in the way of your laws, we wait for you. Your name and renown are the desire of our hearts. My soul yearns for you in the night. In the morning, my spirit longs for you. When your judgments come upon the earth, the people of the world learn righteousness. Though grace is shown to the wicked, they do not learn righteousness. Even in a land of uprightness, they go on doing evil and regard not the majesty of the Lord. O Lord, your hand is lifted high, but they do not see it. Let them see your zeal for your people and be put to shame. Let the fire reserved for your enemies consume them." And there's kind of a picture in Isaiah that's very similar to the one here, where the same set of events is part of a path that's smooth and for the righteous, but a part of a disaster for the wicked. And it doesn't take some kind of exotic being going around that stings some people and not others. It's happening right now. Of course, as we've talked about before, the whole idea that since we're a believer, the pain and suffering we have on earth is part of our eternal sanctification, part of God's benefit to us. So the whole motive and the whole what's happening to us is positive. But for a wicked person, the judgment that's occurring on earth is part of the judgment that's occurring forever, and it's not for their benefit. So you can have the same set of events helping one group of people and harming another. And this is a great way that that can happen. If you believe certain lies, it's bad news. But if you're sealed, you don't believe those lies, and so you don't have those bad news. Okay. Well, that takes us through chapter 9 and the sixth trumpet. Now we're going to have an interlude in this book in chapter 10. The interlude in chapter 10 is suddenly we see something about John and the prophecy itself, and the process of him receiving the prophecy. And so there's sort of an interruption. Now, in chapter 11, we're going to go back to the sixth trumpet. And so there's a break here. It's kind of a parenthetical thing in the middle of the sixth trumpet. Because the sixth trumpet isn't over until we see what the church is doing and what the people of God are doing during the sixth trumpet. But in the meantime, we see this interlude. Now, what John is going to see is some angels. He's going to hear some thunders, and he's going to see a scroll. We're kind of getting a picture of how he's receiving this revelation and what's going on. So, somebody want to read us this chapter? Anybody like to read?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, here, let's give her the microphone. And
Where did you want me to start?
Chapter 10. Just read that chapter. Starting in verse 1.
All right. Then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven. He was robed in a cloud with a rainbow above his head. His face was like the sun, and his legs were like fiery pillars. He was holding a little scroll which lay open in his hand. He planted his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land, and he gave a loud shout like the roar of a lion. When he shouted, the voices of the seven thunders spoke. And when the seven thunders spoke, I was about to write. But I heard a voice from heaven say, seal up what the seven thunders have said and do not write it down. Then the angel I had seen standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven. And he swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created the heavens and all that it is in them, the earth and all that is in it, and the sea and all that is in it, and said, there will be no more delay, but in the days when the seventh angel is about to sound his trumpet, the mystery of God will be accomplished, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. Then the voice that I had heard from heaven spoke to me once more, go, take the scroll that lies open in the hand of the angel who is standing on the sea and on the land. So I went to the angel and asked him to give me the little scroll, and he said to me, take it and eat it. It will turn your stomach sour, but in your mouth it will be as sweet as honey. I took the little scroll from the angel's hand and ate it. It tasted as sweet as honey in my mouth, but when I had eaten it, my stomach turned sour. Then I was told, you must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, languages, and kings.
Okay, so what do you kind of notice in this chapter about the whole process of John receiving this revelation and the prophecy he's giving? What are some of the things that are striking about the whole process of him receiving his material?
Well, in those first verses, I noticed it's really loud. Like he's being told this stuff loudly. with a loud voice like a lion roaring, like seven peals of thunder. I mean, this is, it's in his face.
Okay, it's in his face. By the way, what's the implication of that? It being in his face. What does that tell you about the nature of this?
It's serious.
Just a second. I didn't quite get each of you.
I just said it's serious. They're, you know, but they have better answers.
They have a better answer.
I said, wake up and pay attention.
Wake up and pay attention, okay. And we had another answer over here. John gets his exercise going from one end of the room to the other.
Well, there's a bit of strength and almost anger in it, like, well, pay attention. Those words are just, you better listen.
Okay, you better listen. Kind of reminds us of some of the prophets in the Old Testament. You better listen and you better tell them. So this is not some kind of vague dream. We're talking about something where God's in his face, sending his angel so that John really knows what he's hearing. So there's a force to this. This is a direct, powerful revelation where God is the one telling him what's going on.
This might not be right, but it seems like it's something that he's actually observing happen. Now, in what realm it's happening, at what point in time it's happening, you know, I don't know, but it's happening, and then he's about to write something down, and then he's like restrained from writing down or told, don't write what you just heard down. But otherwise, he's just chronicling what he's,
okay,
what he's actually seeing occur. But yeah. I'm with you. It's not vague. It's not like he's trying to figure out what's going on, or it's like ephemeral in some sense. Like, it seems very urgent, right, and like it's occurring.
Right. It's very clear. And he's even told what not to write down. So what he's letting us know is this book is very much from God. This isn't his own ideas, his own imaginations.
Do we ever get to find out what was the contents of the little book he ate?
Nope. Well, in one sense we do. We see at the last verse, it looks like in verse 11, you must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, languages, and kings, that's what he was told that has to do with that. And maybe the rest of the book gives us more detail then.
There's something really strange here, and that is that John sees himself in the picture. Mm-hmm. I mean, it starts out as if this is what I'm seeing. Verse 8, then the voice I heard from heaven, heard him speaking with me, said, "Go, you, get into the picture, go take the book, which is open in the hand of the angel who stands on the sea." So I went to the angel, telling him, give me the book. Eat it. That's really strange. Where is John? He's in the picture and he's out of the picture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gives us more of a sense of the vividness and reality of what's going on there.
Just a question. You said this is an interlude. Is this going all the way back to the beginning of Revelation? Like, is this the start of the revelation, or is this a revelation within the revelation?
I think what he's doing is it is an interlude, but he's letting us know that everything he's saying is directly from God, and he's being told exactly what to say. And it's not some kind of vague dream that he's now written down. Rather, it's a thing that's clear. God is making him very clear, to the point where he's making sure that his experience of what's going on is quite traumatic. In that sense, it reminds me a lot of Isaiah 6, where when Isaiah was commissioned by God, it would have been a thing very hard for him to have misunderstood, because there he sees the glory of God in the temple, but then the angel comes down with the fires and cleans his tongue and that sort of thing. It's a lot stronger kind of a picture than we might think of. I think sometimes people will envision, in human senses, people will get these ideas and do these things, and they're sort of vague, and they think they know what they're talking about. I think John wants us to know very clearly. He knows exactly, and it's from God, and God has made it clear to him. Yes, we've got another one over here.
I just have a question, and maybe this is obvious to everybody except for me, but why is it sweet in his mouth and turns his stomach sour? I mean, I think of all kinds of analogies. Sin is like that. But is it like a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down? Or like, what is your interpretation of that?
Well, actually, I was going to ask the class that, which means probably I didn't think everybody knew the answer right away. So let's think about that. It was sweet to his mouth, and actually, some of you might even remember another situation in the Bible that's a little like that, but go ahead. What do you think is going on there? Well, it looks like not everybody knows the answer right away.
Okay, I'll give it a shot. It seems to me just like a confirmation of what he has heard. He hears it's going to be sweet in his mouth and bitter in his stomach, and it turns out to be true.
Okay. In other words, some more senses are being brought into this. That's an interesting way to say that, it shows more strongly the fullness of the experience. Okay? Anything else it could mean? Oh, my wife just raised her phone. Well, let's give everybody else a minute more to answer that, and then I'll... Okay, next time we start with that question. After a summary, of course. Gracious Lord, we glorify your wonderful name, and we thank you that you have revealed to us what you're doing, that we might recognize the full force of things that sound banal but aren't, that you are in the process of saving souls in a fallen world. And that great effort is the only thing that really matters in our existence and the reason this world exists. May your name be glorified. Amen.